The Bill Myers Show podcast is sponsored by Clouser Drilling. They've been leading the way in Southern Oregon well drilling for over 50 years. Find out more about them at clouserdrilling.com.
OKMED, here's Bill Myers.
Good morning. It is great having you here on Wheels Up Wednesday. And yes, we will crank up Eric Peters coming up a little bit later this hour with the Wheels Up Wednesday conversation on cars and politics and more. It's always a lot of fun talk there. Kevin Starrett will rejoin the show, too, from Oregon Firearms Federation, because there has been some movement or an update on the ghost gun, the ghost gun lawsuit. And, of course, ghost guns are all throughout the news right now, especially after what happened with the United Healthcare CEO murder. And, of course, the guy, Luigi's been taken into custody and screaming in court and various other things. But we can certainly talk about that with him. And we're also going to talk with a local mother. Got involved, the family got sideways with not only an insurance company, but Mercy Flights, because we've been talking a lot about health insurance and the issues involved with this. And she found, the family found itself being asked to pay about $60,000, $80,000 after a life flight, Mercy Flights, up to Portland. And she's going to end up coming in studio. We'll have a talk with her a little bit after 8 o'clock, and they just kind of want to make sure that people understand what's really going on before you sign the paper to get on the life flight. It is just amazing how something which is necessary at the time, then the insurance company says, you know, it just wasn't medically necessary, you know, that kind of thing. And then, according to, you know, the rules over at Mercy Flights here in Southern Oregon, well, that means you pay up, because the whole idea about Mercy Flights is that they will pay what your insurance company, for the most part, what your insurance company doesn't pay until you get to the medically unnecessary part. Apparently, that's how that works. But anyway, we'll talk with the family involved after that. It's a pretty interesting story. Okay, now then. An always interesting kind of guy. We haven't had a Jeff Merkley update for a long time. So we need a Jeff Merkley update right now for this Wheels Up Wednesday at 6:13.
Oh, tiptoe to the window, by the window, that is where I'll be. Come tiptoe.
I always picture Jeff Merkley, Senator Merkley, with his little butterfly catching net. And, you know, the funny thing about that is that the story has to do with butterflies. Now, maybe this is a really serious issue, but Jeff Merkley has now firmly planted his flag on the side of the monarch butterfly. Oregon U.S. This is from his news release this morning. Oregon U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley, a longtime leader in the fight to revive the population of the iconic Western monarch butterfly, has issued the following statement after the United States Fish and Wildlife Services announced a proposed rule to list the monarch butterfly as threatened under the emergency or the, I'm sorry, yeah, under the Endangered Species Act. By the way, I love monarch butterflies, don't get me wrong, but if Jeff Merkley's in favor of what they're going to do with the Endangered Species Act, I'm just knee-jerking afraid, very afraid. But let me continue to where he's going. Our monarchs are in grave danger. We've all experienced the moment of childhood joy and excitement when we spot a butterfly dancing in the air. And their beauty contributes to the health of our planet, too. So many of the crops we rely on for sustenance depend on pollinators. He's right about that, you know, like bees, sure. But listing the species as threatened is a step in the right direction to save not just the iconic Western monarch, but all monarchs. I've been raising the alarm for years about the many threats to pollinators, including habitat destruction, deadly pesticides and herbicides, and extreme weather fueled by climate chaos. Yeah, there's another code word that you could drive about, 1,000 pages of land use and fuel regulations through, isn't it? Right? Can you hear where this might be going, right? But anyway, the designation under the Endangered Species Act confirms what we have known to be true all along. The monarch butterfly is in danger of extinction if we fail to take bold action to protect them. All right. Now, I would remind you, as they get ready to move forward. Oh, by the way, there's one part of this I forgot. For years, Merkley has led a series of actions to revive the population, and his efforts included hosting the Monarch Butterfly Summits. They actually do this in Washington, D.C.? Apparently they do. The Monarch Butterfly Summits, in partnership with the U.S. Department of the Interior, the first of which announced a $1 million investment in the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation Pollinator Fund and established a Pollinator Conservation Center. This is what they spend time doing in Washington, D.C., apparently, you know, having monarch conferences and such. Now, believe me, I have no axe to grind against the monarch butterfly. Very nice. And maybe we don't have as many of them, but you know, when you tie especially climate chaos to it, this is the whole gangrene thing. There is nothing that can't be done. And you have to wonder, okay, which national parks, which land around here in the state of Oregon will be locked away? You will not be allowed to walk on it, hunt on it. Don't even look at it. If you look at it, you will be endangering the monarch butterfly. Can you see the signs coming up? You can see the signs being made right now. Yet something else. Don't walk in here. Monarch butterflies live here. You know, could you see that coming? And that's why just be very, very concerned when Jeff Merkley gets together with the Endangered Species Act and says, I think this is just wonderful. And everybody remembers, you know, what it was like as a child with a monarch butterfly. Now, it would seem to me that if we're really concerned about pollinators, couldn't we all just go down to Valley View Nursery and buy a bunch of lavender and plant it everywhere? And then the butterflies and the bees would just go to our gardens and yards. Wouldn't that be the easier thing? Do we have to put it on the Endangered Species Act? Or do we just have to just say, hey, why don't we just plant some more pollinator-friendly plants? I mean, wouldn't that be the thing to do? Or would the monarch butterflies not be fooled by such a simple trick? There has to be some equivalent of the Lomakatse project out there, you know, doing things in the wild. They would have to plant government-approved plants in the wild that would be favorable to monarch butterflies. You know, this is the way the government works. It's always a grift for some nonprofit someplace. This is my opinion. Okay. And let's see, what's the other big news this morning? Statement from A.G. Rosenblum. Oh, no. Anytime the Rosenblum burps out a press release, something's going bad. Earlier today, Judge Adrian Nelson of the United States District Court for the District of Oregon granted the state of Oregon's request for an injunction that would block the Kroger-Albertsons merger from moving forward. This is like Albertsons Safeway, and of course, Kroger, we know it is Fred Meyer. Judge Nelson's ruling confirms our argument that the proposed merger would be harmful to consumers and workers alike. At a time when higher grocery and pharmacy prices are hurting countless households, today's decision is a win for Oregonians and a win for competition in the marketplace. And so Rosenblum is just absolutely ecstatic about this this deal being blocked. And you know who else is really thrilled with it? Senator Ron Wyden, Senator Snagglepuff, U.S. Senator Ron Wyden today. Now, I promise I wasn't going to do that anymore, right? I can't help myself. But U.S. Senator Ron Wyden today issuing the following statement in response to the news of the Kroger-Albertsons merger going down in flames. This is great news for grocery shoppers in Oregon. Okay, I'll stop. Who would have faced higher prices at Kroger and Albertsons if this ill-conceived consolidation had gone through? Said Wyden, who led lawmakers in filing an amicus brief with a federal court opposing this merger. I'm glad the court has shelved this monster deal because in addition to raising grocery prices for shoppers already tiptoeing on an economic tightrope, it would have made it that much harder for Oregonians to find a pharmacy and for workers at both supermarket chains to seek fairer wages and better working conditions. There we go. Ron Wyden. Married to the multimillionaire living in New York or wherever it is. He's a man of the people. Yeah, we get it. We get it, Ron. We get it. I get the impression, though, that there's just a lot of people who are economically illiterate on everything about this. And it makes my teeth hurt when I think about the economic illiteracy the communism, the Marxism, the principles that are going through here. Oh, it's okay if darling of the left, Amazon, gets absolutely massive, right? And takes over practically more than half of retail, it seems, some days. But that Albertsons and Safeway and Fred Meyer Kroger might get together and try to save their businesses. That's reducing competition. And what about the pharmacies? Yeah, what about the pharmacies, state of Oregon? What about the pharmacies? One of the reasons why they ended up killing this Safeway, Albertsons, and Fred Meyer merger is that they're talking about the loss of pharmacies. You know what has caused more loss of pharmacies than anything else in the state of Oregon? The corporate activity tax that Oregon imposed on them. Remember Bi-Mart? Bi-Mart had dozens and dozens of pharmacies around here, all over the place. They couldn't make it work because it's lots of money through that business, and it's a low margin. It's a very low profit margin. And that's why Bi-Mart had to let it go. They had to stop it. They were losing money on it. You'd have a lot of money that would go there because the drugs were very expensive, but Bi-Mart didn't make a lot of money on each of those transactions. And then the corporate tax then requires Bi-Mart to pay a lot of tax on money that didn't necessarily give them a profit. This is the economic illiteracy that is running this country, and especially running the state of Oregon that Senator Wyden represents. Okay? You know, it just, like I said, makes my teeth hurt, makes my eyes hurt, head hurt, you know, everything else like this. And the same thing in the grocery store business. It is a high volume. Lots of money goes through your grocery stores, but it's very low profit margin. You have to sell an awful lot of chuck steak to be able to pay the bills around there. It's like, on average, on the low end, 1% profit margin. On the high end, about 3%. 1 to 3%. But of course, according to the Ron Wydens of the world and the Senator Jeff Merkleys and their supporters, the people who vote for them, that's corporate greed. Corporate greed. I guess he would say the same thing about employee-owned Bi-Mart too, right? Corporate greed. That's why they got rid of the pharmacy. No, they're trying to keep things alive. The only way you're able to make this, think about that, 1 to 3% profit margin. In other words, you sell something worth $100 at the grocery store, $100 of groceries, which is what, you know, 1.5 bags today, especially if you bought any steak. You know, maybe a bag. All right, maybe a bag. $100 bag of groceries at Sherm's or wherever you happen to be shopping this morning. Sherm's, Winco, Albertsons, Safeway, Fred Meyer, I mean, all of them. Your typical 100 bag or $100 bag of groceries makes the company $1 to $3. $1 to $3 out of a $100 sale going out the door. That's not a lot of money. It's an awful lot of expenses that have to be paid before that ends up happening. And that's the reason why Safeway, Albertsons, and Fred Meyer Kroger wanted to merge. Because they're competing against the likes of Costco. High volume, low profit margin, right? That sort of thing. They're competing with Amazon, which has taken over so many things. And, of course, they're worried about the pharmacies. If the state of Oregon was really worried about the pharmacies, they would repeal the corporate activity tax. But no, can't do that. Have to make those greedy corporations pay their fair share. Save us from these economic illiterates. And frankly, you know, a lot of we folks living in Oregon are just as economically illiterate. It's like, well, gosh, you know, I kind of like having my neighborhood Safeway. Maybe the neighborhood Safeway is losing money, though. They're just trying to keep it alive. Yeah, we don't seem to mind the online and the club type of places taking over retail. But boy, I'll tell you, you know, you have some of the neighborhood stores trying to band together. It's about saving money and cutting costs and making things more efficient. It's about it's almost like the way it is right now in today's semi-fascistic America is that you either have to get big or you're going to die. And that's what Safeway and Fred Meyer merging was all about. And Albertsons, that's what it was all about. Got to get either bigger, more efficient, or die. That's just where we find ourselves right now. But it's okay. Jeff Bezos gets a pass, right? Yikes. It's 626 at KMED. Thank you, Senator Wyden. Thank you, Senator Merkley, because I know we'll see the butterflies flying ever more happily next summer. God bless you.
KMED.
28 minutes after 6. Appreciate you being here. We're going to talk with Eric Peters in just a moment after the news. We catch up with things. More of your calls. Kevin Starrett talks the ghost gun. Look at that lawsuit. The latest on that. And a whole bunch more. Let's do some emails of the day. A couple of them. We got a bunch, but I'll do a couple for right now. Emails of the day sponsored by Dr. Steve Nelson, Central Point Family Dentistry, centralpointfamilydentistry.com. And while you wait, crowns available. They have a great new in-house lab now. They used to have to send that stuff out of town, and you had to wait for a week or two. Nope. A lot of times, like 30 minutes, they get the computer in your mouth, and they shove it into there, and the little mill starts going, you know, whizzing away in the back room. It's great. Ask it. Dr. Steve will show you that, okay? CentralPointFamilyDentistry.com. Okay? Next to the Mazatla Mexican restaurant. Jerry the Bull writes me this morning, Bill, I'm of the belief that words mean something. Language is important. I would agree with you. So why is it, according to Investopedia, Bill, that there is no explicit definition of lawful money? Why has Congress not clarified this monetary phrase? Isn't it staggering to think that people in the fields of banking and law are confused by this terminology? To me, it's staggering to ponder. However, I believe I know why there's never been a clearly defined deal of lawful money. Just ask yourself, who benefits from the secrecy, and you'll be on the right track. In the meantime, I'll act in accordance with what I've learned. Jerry, I appreciate your writing. Always thoughtful. Jerry the Bull. Now, Betty writes here from Josephine County. Good morning, Bill. A little rant about the monarch butterfly with Senator Merkley, but in the summer, my butterfly bush, Betty says, is covered with the monarchs. They are the snowbirds in the winter. They go to Mexico in the winter, I believe. There are a ton of plants to use to attract them to our gardens. This, according to Betty from Joe County. And she closes with, I'm also doing a happy dance. Adam Schiff stepping down. Yahoo! Haven't heard why yet. I hate that pencil neck. Laugh out loud. Betty Martin. Betty, I'm sorry to be a downer, a Debbie Downer here with you, but Adam Schiff is being sworn in as a senator. That's why he stepped down from the House. He's actually going to be Senator Schiff. Yeah, Senator Schiff. I know. I didn't. And so I know a lot of people didn't realize he was going to be in the Senate. But yeah, that's the story. That's why he stepped down from the House. Yes, if only he was just stepping down and returning to the private sector to maybe set up a life with, you know, Bang Bang or Fang Fang or, you know, whatever her name was. But be that as it may, that's what happened, Betty. Sorry. Let me go to Tom. Hey, Tom, how you doing this morning? Welcome.
Wow, Bill, the ship going into the Senate, it really, I think they had to declare all of California a mental hazard zone and realize that people have gone insane.
Yeah, well, I think Betty has been triggered now that she realizes that Betty, or that Adam Schiff is going to remain in Congress, has actually, in other words, Adam Schiff, as incompetent and miserable as he is, has now been given a promotion. Isn't that great? Gotta love it.
That's kind of the way our government is working these days. It doesn't belong to it's just absolutely insane. Anyway, I wanted to talk about what you were talking about, the butterflies and so forth. Mm-hmm. There was a during the Harris campaign for president, there was floated out an idea about kind of like a wealth tax. And that would mean like ordinary people, like, say, your house, if your house, because of inflation, went from 200,000 to 500,000 just through inflation.
Yeah, you'd have to pay a tax on the you'd have to pay a tax to the government on the extra value of your stuff, right?
That kind of thing. Supposedly, and mm-hmm. of course, all that increased value is due to inflation because of the corruption of the United States government. So that's the kind of mindset of the people that are running this country. It's frightening it's an idiocracy.
Agreed, unfortunately. And it's up to people like you and me and other listeners this morning to try to spread some modicum of truth about how the world really works this morning, you know?
Well, you know what you said about, why Bi-Mart had to close down the pharmacy. I wish Bimart would have made some kind of effort to send out a notice to every home in Oregon to explain what happened to them. Because right now, 99 out of 100 people don't understand what you just said.
The state of Oregon essentially killed Bimart's pharmacy because it was, and by the way, I thought they were doing a great job. I loved the pharmacy at Bimart. It ended up being convenient. But the challenge is that it was probably a loss leader for them. Lots of money goes through it. And just because you have lots of money going through the department doesn't mean you're making a lot of money on it. But you still had to pay tax to the state of Oregon for it because Bimart was a big employee-owned company. It's just the way it is.
Well, Oregon has become such a poorly run state. What they did with COVID vaccines and the mandates and putting businesses out of business and so forth, and this corporate wealth tax and so forth. I mean, it's a pretty frightening situation to consider how stupidly this state is being run.
And hopefully, less stupid over time would be really good. Appreciate the caller, Tom. Always appreciate you checking in. It is 6:34. We're going to catch up on the rest of the news here. Eric Peters will then rejoin the program, Wheels Up Wednesday. And if you want to talk cars and have a question about something maybe you're looking at, maybe you're looking for a good deal, 770-5633. We'll get that rolling in just a minute.
Matt here with an urgent message from the Josephine County Republican Party.
That's 770-KMED.
And the reason you want to call is because Eric Peters is on, epautos.com, automotive journalist and genius at EP Autos, like I said. Gosh, you have been doing this for a long, long time. How many years have you been in the auto journalism and the auto trade here, Eric?
It's coming up on 30 years, which is, wow, tempus fugit, right? It's astounding. It feels like it's still 1995, but I guess it isn't anymore.
You have seen a lot of changes in the industry throughout the years. And in fact, one of the cars that you have on the front page of epautos.com, and I have a feeling I know where you're going with it. I haven't had a chance to read the article yet, but it is 50-plus miles per gallon once upon a time, because we're told now that everything has to be done for efficiency. We have to, try to raise fuel economy, corporate fuel economy. And we had already done it before, and then something happened. And on the front of this article, you have a picture. Now, the first new car I ever bought was a 1982 Chevrolet Chevette. And honestly, that was not that great of a car, but it was a great starter car, for me at that time. But they had a 50-mile-per-gallon diesel version of it, too, didn't they?
Yeah, 55 miles per gallon, actually. And I was using that as the springboard for a discussion about the change in etymology. Some people will remember when we had such a thing as the economy car.
Yeah.
And a Chevette, that is kind of the eponymous economy car. It was built not only to be affordable to buy, but also affordable to drive, hence economy car. Now, what we have are entry-level cars, and all of these entry-level cars are equipped with luxury features, or at least things that were once considered luxurious.
Oh, yeah, well, they're loaded to the gills with everything. I remember when, in that Chevette, if I wanted air conditioning, I think you had to buy it separately, and it was like something put in by a local company, around it. They didn't come from the factory that way. You had to pay a lot extra for it. Just one example.
And the thing is, it was inexpensive. It was inexpensive to buy. It was inexpensive to drive, very inexpensive to drive, particularly with regard to the diesel, because as you remember, back in those days, diesel actually cost less than gas.
Yeah.
So, really, it wasn't just that you got another 20 miles per gallon versus the gas-powered iteration of the same vehicle. You were paying less for the fuel on top of that. So it was a really good deal. Now we have these entry-level cars, which are all pretty pricey. And the only way that you can get a car that can replicate the efficiency of operation of something like that Chevette diesel is to get a hybrid. Now you have to pay for multiple tandem drivetrain. You've got an engine plus electric motors, it's often plural, there's often two, plus an EV-style battery that adds to the cost and the complexity of the thing. And all for what? So you can end up with a vehicle that gets about the same gas mileage that you got out of an 82 Chevette.
Well, how often have we talked about cars that had great mileage in the 1980s, 1990s? One that comes to mind is the Honda? What was that little roller skate?
Oh, the Civic CRX HF.
Yeah, the Civic CRX HF, which I believe got more than 50 miles per gallon just stock, and that was with a carburetor. back in the day.
It did. And again, it was because it was very light. So was the Chevette. The Chevette weighed about 2,200 pounds. I think the Civic weighed something like 1,800 pounds. Now, to put that in some context, a brand new Toyota Corolla hybrid weighs close to 3,000 pounds. It weighs 2,800 something pounds.
And ultimately, you know, the fatter and heavier your car is, the lower your mileage is overall. You have fuel or some form of energy that's going to move that gargantuan weight around, right?
Yep. And if we could, you know, look at this from another direction, if you are able to cut down the weight of something like the Corolla Hybrid, the current model, bring that weight down to about what the weight of an 82 Chevette was, and put the same efficient drivetrain in that thing, instead of getting 50-something miles per gallon, you'd probably be getting close to 70.
But I don't think that would actually work with the agenda, because the agenda is not about having fast, safe, light cars that are highly fuel efficient. I think the agenda is about getting you out of a car, just getting out of the car, period, unless you're a very wealthy elite, I think is where they want to go.
I agree. I think that that's a reasonable assessment of the situation, because in every instance when vehicles that were inexpensive and efficient were available, the regulatory apparatus used its power to regulate, to push them off the road. And now the regulatory apparatus has been eyeing the hybrids, as you and I have talked about in the past. You know, these vehicles that are the latest iteration of the high-efficiency vehicle, and, you know, they've found something wrong with them, too. So now they've got to go.
Okay, well, what's wrong with the hybrid? What are they finding wrong with the hybrid now? What's that?
Well, particularly, specifically, the plug-in hybrid, the Redguard Reagan, the outgoing head of the EPA, has been whining about how people aren't plugging them in enough.
Mm. Damn you people. Using the gasoline motor inside that thing, right?
You know, I one thing I'd like to mention, because I think it's important, and I hope it gets people angry. Volkswagen had been working on a hybrid commuter car, ultra lightweight, that would use a diesel engine in tandem with the hybrid secondary part of its drivetrain. And this thing was going to average about 100 miles per gallon. And they were working on this around 2016.
100 miles per gallon? That's like a corporate nirvana for fuel economy around here, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it was small. It was a two-seater. It was designed to be a commuter. But the point is 100 miles per gallon or more than that. And, you know, that was curb-stomped and pushed off the market right around the time that all of Volkswagen's diesels, which all got 50-something miles per gallon and all cost around $23,000, were pushed off the market by the regulatory apparatus.
Was it one of those things where the EPA types had to go after Volkswagen, even though, you know, okay, so they broke the rules, right? But they charged them billions of dollars in fines and essentially made them walk the plank, right?
Even that isn't the right way to put it, in my opinion. What they did was they programmed their vehicles to pass the tests, which they did. And every car manufacturer does that. They understand, okay, this is the test. What do we have to do to pass the test?
Yeah, but you have to understand that Volkswagen, with their high-efficiency diesels like that, they embarrassed the electric vehicle agenda. They made you look at an electric vehicle and say, why the hell would I want to get this piece of garbage at twice the price?
I think that's it. You know, there's a reason why Volkswagen was specifically targeted. There were other diesels available, but for the most part, they were being sold by high-end luxury brands like BMW and Mercedes, and so there was a limited niche market for them. Volkswagen, on the other hand, had a whole lineup of affordable mass-market diesel-powered cars like the Golf, the Beetle, the Jetta, that people could buy for less than $25,000 that had a 700-mile range that got 50-something miles per gallon on the highway and would run for 300,000 miles before anything major fell apart.
Now, were they selling these over in Europe? Because from what I understand, way more diesel vehicles are on the road over in Europe, as far as passenger cars go, than they are in the United States.
Absolutely.
It just ended up dying after Volkswagen. So why was Europe okay with it and we weren't?
Well, the regs were different over there. You know, gas already is exorbitantly expensive in all of the countries of Western Europe, you know, to the tune of, I think it's, what is it, about $8 a gallon now, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, diesel was a way for people to continue to be able to drive. They haven't yet gotten around to forcing people out of cars in the way that they're doing it here. They're just doing it differently. And now they're going after the diesels, too. For example, I think in Paris, people who have diesel-powered vehicles aren't allowed to drive them in the city. And there are other areas where if you have a diesel-powered vehicle, you get special fines, special punishing fines for daring to affront the climate change god.
Mm. So back to what you were talking about in the beginning here with, you know, we had high mileage, low cost vehicles back in the day. It wasn't all that long ago, all right? a generation or two, right?
In fact, you know, you fast forward a little bit, it wasn't just a phenomenon of the 80s. Even up into the 90s, you know, you could still buy every major manufacturer that wasn't a luxury brand had an entry-level car. You know, there were cars like the Ford Aspire, just pulling it out of my head, Geo Metro. There were a bunch of little cars, Chevy Cavalier, and so on, that were sort of the car that you got if you couldn't yet afford a Taurus, let's say, something higher up the food chain that cost a little bit more. Now you go to one of these places, and all they've got are crossovers that are much more expensive, and then you jump up from there into these gigantic SUVs that cost $50,000, $60,000, $70,000.
What is the equivalent? Is there anything that could qualify as what you would term the economy car of yesteryear on the lots from any of the manufacturers today? Or what is the nearest equivalent if someone was looking for one?
The last two that were available, one was the Mitsubishi Mirage, and the other, I think, was the Nissan Sentra, or the Sentra still available? I'm not sure. The Sentra and the Hyundai Accent. Remember the Hyundai Accent?
Yeah, I do.
They're either off the market or will be off the market next year. So as of 2025, you will not be able to buy a new vehicle for less than $20,000.
Wow. Okay. And when I think that my first house was only about a little more than double that cost, that kind of gives a lot of people pause, doesn't it? Gets people out of the out of the automotive world, right?
I don't know whether you caught the other article I did. I did a little rough math about something. You know, we've talked about my 02 Nissan Frontier pickup. Mm-hmm. And when it was new, it cost about $13,000, and that was 23 years ago. And I juxtaposed that against the 24 model Toyota Hilux Champ, which you and I have talked about, that costs $13,000 today, in today's money.
In today's money, it's $13,000. Wow. Okay.
Well, and the thing is,
but we're not allowed to buy it here.
Inflation.
But we're not allowed
here's
to buy it here.
Okay. This is the interesting. You know, you can't buy the Hilux here, but here's what I thought was interesting. If you adjust what I paid for my, well, what somebody, I'm the second owner, but what the truck cost originally in today's dollars, it would be about $23,000 today.
Wow.
That's still relatively inexpensive, but consider that the Hilux, today's Hilux, is essentially the same thing as my Frontier was back in 02. They're very similar. But the price difference in real terms is about $10,000. And that's a metric of how we get less and pay more.
So if we were able to get something like that Toyota Hilux, which is a small little pickup truck type thing, right?
Basic little pickup truck.
Yeah, basic, and the kind of stuff that you used to be able to buy. Would it be kind of a similar? I've never seen one of these. All right, I think I recall reading it in your articles on EP Autos, but is it something akin to what we used to be able to buy, like the Ford Couriers and the old Datsun trucks and
very similar, and in some ways better. It has a 2,000-pound bed payload capacity, which is more than what my little Frontier is rated for. It has a 4-cylinder engine like my truck that produces almost exactly the same horsepower. Comes standard with a 5-speed manual transmission, and wait, there's more. It's available with a diesel engine with a manual transmission, which, of course, is completely verboten in the United States today.
Yeah, and that is the article up on EP, We Could Have More for Less, right? That's what that is,
yep.
That vehicle.
Yep.
Yeah. Check it out there, epautos.com, 10 before 7. Eric, we need to get into some of your reviews this morning here, too. So why don't we talk about that here in a couple, all right?
Sure.
And if you wanted to talk with Eric and ask a question about a vehicle, maybe you're looking at something for yourself or someone, that a friend or a loved one, things like that, this guy knows this stuff. 770-5633. Comments, welcome, too.
Attention, Jackson County.
You're hearing the Bill Myers Show on 106.3 KMED.
Sorry, I was just getting ready, getting Eric back on. I didn't realize it was such a short one. But yeah, here he is, Eric Peters, epautos.com. Now, Eric, we were going to talk. I just mentioned to you briefly something that was making my teeth hurt this morning, is that everyone is doing the happy dance because the merger between a couple of large grocery store chains, huge grocery store chains, has been knocked down. And the economic illiteracy that infects the entire country right now is just so much. And in this case, they say that Kroger, Fred Meyer can't merge with Albertsons because it would stop competition and reduce pharmacies. And yet at the same time, state of Oregon taxes, has put pharmacies out of business around here because of corporate activity taxes that they put in there. You know, lots of money goes through the place. You got to pay the state whether or not you made money on it or not. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that we go on. But nobody goes after. Nobody says anything about Amazon, Costco, anything else. That's all right. Those are good.
Yeah.
Those are good lacks of competition, I guess, for everybody.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. You know, one of my favorite sci-fi writers was Philip Dick, and He wrote a novel back in the 60s called Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? Most people are more familiar with the movie Blade Runner that was based on the book. And one of the subplots of the book and the movie is that in the future, in this dystopian future, basically everything is controlled by this one gigantic corporation. You know, if you want anything, you have to appeal to this one, and it was housed in a pyramidal structure corporation.
This is it.
Interestingly enough.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what we're heading. I mean, it feels like ultimately within a relatively short time from now, we're going to basically be beholden to Jeff Bezos and Amazon, and that's the only place we're going to be able to get anything.
And when you hear Kroger and Albertsons, not that I'm, you know, fans of their grocery stores, okay, because I tend to go to a local chain who I'm sure is also having a tough time competing, you know, out there, you know, in this world right now. It's like, you know, you either have to get big to go against the Amazons or else you're going to get crushed eventually. That's the way the system seems to be wanting it, really.
Sure, sure. And, you know, I think the fundamental core problem is that things are set up now that it's essentially impossible for any new upstart business to get into that business and try to offer more for less, you know, a better value for the customer. You almost have to be some gigantic corporation to enter into any field of commerce today.
Yeah. It's 6:54. We're talking with Eric Peters, and happy to take your calls here now, too. And then we'll get to your review, too, before we take off, Eric.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Let me go to line three. Hi, good morning. You're on with Eric Peters. Who's this? And what's your question or comment?
Yes, sir. This will be Gregory out in Central Point.
Yeah, Gregory, can you talk in your phone a little more directly? It's a little mushy. Hard to hear you.
Is that better?
Oh, much better. Go ahead. Keep going.
Okay. So thank you to both of you gentlemen. I heard you could ask a question. I'm going to ask the question about the 2019 Dodge Ram 1500 Classic.
Uh-huh.
I just purchased, and I wondered, with a six-cylinder four-wheel drive, I wonder if Eric thought that was a nice automobile.
Yeah, the classic one. What do you think, Eric?
Yeah, I do, particularly if you didn't get the e-torque system with the V6. Did you?
I'm not sure what an e-torque is, and I'm not sure what's in the audit that is, and I'm going to talk to somebody about a couple things later today. But what is e-torque? It might be in one of the manuals.
Well, essentially, it is what they call a mild hybrid system with a 48-volt battery that's behind the back seat and a belt-driven starter generator system that they use to cycle the 3.6-liter V6 off as often as possible to save gas and reduce emissions. And it's an overly elaborate, failure-prone piece, so I would advise against getting it. Now, if you don't have it, good news, because the 3.6 Chrysler is a really good engine, you know, and the Ram is a really good truck, too. So, you know, other than that e-torque qualification, I think you did well.
So, have you already bought it, or are you looking at buying it?
Yes, I have it, and I'm taking it to my mechanics sometime when I get an appointment, and I will ask that gentleman.
Okay.
So both of you have a great holiday season. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. Appreciate that, Greg. Let me go to the next one. Hi, you're with the EP Autos, Eric Peters. Who's this? Good morning. Hello.
Hey, Bill, it's Brad. Good morning to you and Eric.
Morning, Brad. What's your question?
So the discussion about, you know, affordability of transportation is so important to everybody. You know, you guys are, Eric was talking about those great Volkswagens that would run forever, sit diesel. But there's a deal here that you guys understand that a lot of people have missed in this thing, which is what I call passenger density. So the cost of operating a vehicle is what it costs you to buy the vehicle, maintain the vehicle, minus whatever you can recover the vehicle when you get through selling it at the end of its cycle, divided into the number of miles that you've driven the thing, right? That's what it actually costs. And you can come up with a cost per mile. But then you have to factor in the passenger density. So my wife and I had four kids. That means we needed a vehicle that would have a minimum of six passenger capacity. So what we did is we had Suburbans. So people say, oh, my God, Suburbans are so expensive. But not really. Not our Suburbans had between eight and nine passenger capacity, which meant that the actual cost per person per mile transported was really, really low. And they lost almost no value over their lifespan. You guys want to talk about that a little bit, passenger density and actual cost per mile per person?
No, that's absolutely correct. You know, buying one vehicle is, generally speaking, a lot less expensive than buying two. And another of the things that we've lost, this is the other aspect of this, is that there was a time when you could buy a nice big family sedan that had bench seats up in front and bench seats in back and could seat six people, so that you did not need to buy a vehicle that had three rows, as you essentially have to do today, because there isn't any vehicle that only has two rows of seats that can seat six or seven people.
So there are ways to get more efficient and get those passenger costs per mile down, like Brad was talking about, you know, without having to go necessarily to the largest vehicle on the planet, right? There were ways to do it before. Brad, thanks for the call and for raising that issue. Let me go to another line. Hello, caller. You're on with Eric Peters. Who's this?
Hi. I sure appreciate your guys' show, both you, Bill, and the auto show. But
thank you.
I was driving one of those VW Rabbit pickups for 20 years until some jerk ran into me and totaled the car, and I probably should have had it fixed and bought it from insurance or whatever. But now I'm one of the vehicles I have is an 89 Toyota pickup, four-wheel drive, and it is a dog on gas. I'd say I'm lucky to get 20 miles to the gallon. Do you think is there something inherently wrong with what's going on, I don't know, that I can do to get that up? And it's a four-cylinder.
Yeah, well, I've got the same problem. My 02 Nissan Frontier is very similar. And the problem that you've got to begin with is you've got a relatively underpowered engine for a fairly heavy vehicle for the power. However, I think the problem that you likely have is that one or both of your catalytic converters is partially or even more than partially clogged up after all these years. I know that was an issue with mine. I had two. I had a close coupled one up near the intake exhaust manifold and another one further downstream. And I simply removed the one downstream and noticed a marked and immediate improvement both in the responsiveness of the truck and the mileage. It went up by about 3 or 4 miles per gallon just by doing that.
Now, I would imagine that late 80s, you're no longer under the you don't have to get it smog tested any longer, do you? I don't think you do.
No, no.
Yeah.
No. Can you still get those catalytic, or can you replace those, or do you have to?
Oh, absolutely.
Can you clean them?
Absolutely. They're universal and generic at this point. You would not have to get the exact Toyota type cat that came with it. Just something that's what they call OE or original equipment compliant or similar. And any auto parts store would be able to find you with, you know, help you with that to find the correct one.
So you might be able to get 3-4 miles a gallon just by replacing it. And I would imagine at that age, those catalytic converters can't be in great shape at this point, right, Eric?
No way. It's just inevitable. You know, if you've ever cut one open and looked at it, it's sort of like a honeycomb lattice with very fine passages. And, you know, even a very efficient, properly tuned engine, there's a degree of carbon and soot that comes out of the exhaust, and that over time will build up on the surface of that lattice and decrease the flow. Now, you know, given the age of the truck, if it were my truck, I would cut that converter right off, and I just put a piece of pipe in its place and drive on happily.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And you have fun, and I'm not going to tell anyone, okay?
Thank you so much.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you for the call. Hey, Eric, before we take off, you always perform a great service with wonderful reviews of some of the latest vehicles. And last week, you actually did we talk about the Dodge Durango last week? Or did
No, we didn't. We didn't have time, and I think we ought to.
Okay, yeah. The Dodge Durango, is this the last run for the Durango, or is this going to keep going here for a little while? Because we know that Fiat, Chrysler, or no, it's Stellantis. You know, Stellantis is rumored to be kind of circling the drain here, and they're wondering what the future is of it. And Stellantis doesn't seem to be much interested in selling Dodges these days.
No. Well, you know, we have talked at length about the retirement, the forced retirement of the Hemi V8 from pretty much all of the Stellantis products, all of the Dodge products, including the Charger and the Challenger, Jeeps, and even the Ram truck, which now has an inline six with a turbo and hybrid and all that stuff. But a little known fact, you can still get the Durango with the Hemi V8, and not just the 5.7, but you can still get it in Hellcat form with the 6.2 supercharged V8. And this is the last call. That's it. You know, this is the last run of that particular vehicle. Now, the Durango may come back in 26 in some mutated form, but it's not going to come back with the Hemi V8.
Okay, so if you want the big one, you want to grab one of those right now and could end up being the future collector car. Now, another one of your latest reviews here, the 2025 Nissan Altima. Not exactly what you would call. Well, is that an entry level car at Nissan or not?
No. It's considered, you know, it's considered a mid-sized, mid-priced family type of car. Now, in the past, up until now, the Altima has always been considered one of the more sporty sedans in the segment. You'll probably remember when it was available with the V6, very similar to the one that was in the Maxima, and you could even get it with a manual transmission. So it was kind of a four-door sports car. Nissan actually used that to describe the Maxima, and the Altima was very similar. Of course, the V6 is gone. It's been gone for a while, and now the previously available optional turbo variable displacement engine is gone, so it comes only with the 2.5-liter engine, which isn't very powerful, but it's still a great family car. Doesn't have a turbo. It's not a hybrid. Gets good gas mileage. It's comfortable. It's not exciting. It's not flashy, but is a family car supposed to be those things? You know, it's worth looking at if you're interested in just a good family car that isn't a really expensive car.
And the good thing about the 2.5-liter engine is that even though it's a four-cylinder, it's not a tiny four-cylinder, which so many vehicles are being equipped with. This is just a good size. My Chrysler has a 2.5. Yeah, 2.5-liter.
Yeah, as a cross-reference, the Honda Accord, which is one of the competitors in the segment, it comes with a 1.5-liter engine, if you can imagine. And it has to have a turbo, and it makes about the same power, slightly more. I think it's 192 versus 188, but essentially it's the same deal. But you can imagine what kind of power that 1.5-liter engine would make if it didn't have the turbo.
Yeah, not very much. That's just the way that goes. Now, out of curiosity, though, what is your impression, though, about the future of Nissan as a car company? Because it is another one like Stellantis that has been on the bubble here for a little while. What are we thinking?
Well, it's disastrous. It's even worse, according to the numbers that are currently available, than Stellantis. They're really doing badly. And part of the reason, of course, is that they have embraced the electric car tar baby, worse than a lot of the other manufacturers. Their quality hasn't been particularly good. They've really lost their way. Infiniti, their luxury line, is in a disastrous, torpid state. They're going to have to do some major, major changes very, very soon. I think one of their CEOs, one of their high-up people, said something like they have about 12 to 14 months to salvage things before the company goes bankrupt.
Is there a CEO like a Lee Iacocca type there that would be up to the task of saving it? Because, you know, like I said, they were one of the people that went early in on the electric vehicle. Remember the Nissan Leaf, right? We got that.
I'm sure there is. It's a question of whether the board will bring such a person on board and whether that person will have the power to do the things that might be necessary. You know, one of the things I would recommend, I mean, I've owned a number of Nissan pickups, but I don't want one of the new offerings. You know, the new Frontier is basically a full-size truck now, and it's $30,000 to start. How about bringing something back that costs about $15,000? If they did that, I bet they'd be selling a lot of small trucks.
And you're getting people to, once again, get loyal. You get them into your dealership, and you get them, and maybe you'd even get some young people actually buying some of their cars. Wouldn't that be great? Huh?
That's how you do it. Right. You establish brand loyalty and good feelings so that the kid who buys a car when he's 24, 25 will come back a few years later when he's married and needs something bigger. And he'll, you know, he'll pay a little bit more for it, and the dealer will make money, and the company makes money.
It's the way they used to do it. Seemed to work well for a while, all right? Eric Peters, epautos.com. Great site as always. Eric, what are you going to be reviewing for next week? What's going to be coming? Do you know?
I did it again, Bill. I didn't make a note to myself to people tell you what's coming.
I'll talk with you about it next Wednesday, then. Forget about it. Don't worry about it, okay?
We'll do it
next Wednesday. But epautos.com, thank you, and we'll talk then. Thanks.
Thank you, Bill.
This is KMED, KMED HD1, Eagle Point, Medford. KPXG Grants Pass, Town Hall News next.